people ask me sometimes, you know, why does the church hate gay people? And I'm like, oh, that question, there's so much in that. I could spend an hour just unpacking that. One, I don't believe there's just gay people. I think we're broken people and we go to broken vessels. We go to brokenness. And then the church doesn't hate people. No, what the church that Christ set up, the church hates sin because who's behind sin is Satan. And Satan is the hateful one.
Magnificat is excited to introduce Magnifier, a new bi-monthly magazine for children ages 7 to 12, filled with wholesome offline entertainment that will awaken their sense of wonder to what is good and beautiful around them. Each issue focuses on one theme, approaching it from different angles. Comics, stories, interviews with artisans, crafts, and art encourage children to appreciate creation and dream about what they can accomplish with their talents. Check it out for yourself at magnifiermagazine.com.
Hey, thanks for joining us today on Our Reason for Hope. I just found out the other day from one of our producers that, you know, more than half the people that watch this show, this podcast, do not subscribe to us. This is insane. I mean, what are you waiting for? Hit the subscribe button now. All right, back to the show.
Welcome back to A Reason for Hope. And today we're diving into a topic that can be confusing, emotional, and often misunderstood, what the Catholic Church actually teaches about same-sex attraction, and how we're called to respond with both truth and love. But this isn't just a theoretical conversation. It's deeply personal. Our guest today is Kim Zember, a Catholic speaker who shares her powerful story of experiencing same-sex attraction, living a double life, and ultimately encountering Jesus in a way that transformed her sense of her identity and her life. We'll also talk about how parents and other family members can walk with young people navigating these questions in today's culture. Kim, welcome to the show. It's so great to have you here.
It's an honor to be on.
So you grew up Catholic, but you've said that you didn't really know Jesus in a personal way. What did your faith look like growing up?
Yeah, I mean, I went to church. I received all the sacraments, went through all sac prep. So I learned a lot about God. I had a lot of knowledge of God. I would say more than knowledge about God, I had a lot of knowledge about his rules. So I knew what was wrong. I was taught what was wrong. I was taught what was right. The problem was the dissonance I felt in my heart where I was like, okay, I've got the list, but I can't do this. I didn't know the heart of God the Father. I didn't know the gospel message that I'm weak and Jesus will be my strength, like that it's good to be weak. We can be honest with that. And so that left just an exhausting kind of everyday life. Like, wow. I mean, and that was when I was young. So now imagine, you know, getting into high school and things when it's really hard. That I would say that was kind of the framework. I saw God more as a cop, an accountant, a CPA. Nothing wrong with cops. Nothing wrong with accountants. Very grateful for them. Really just always keeping score, keeping tabs. The things I do good, he writes down. The things I do bad, I get pulled over, get a ticket. And it was pretty daunting.
Yes. So I would expect, therefore, when you were growing up and you started to feel things you didn't expect maybe to be feeling, that the sense that God is a moral rule maker, and yet it seems just on a normal day, I'm incapable of keeping that law, that now this is a real wrench in the works for you. So when did that experience of same-sex attraction begin for you? And what did that feel like for you, especially in light of this upbringing? What was going through your heart and your mind?
Yeah, you said it really well, honestly. I mean, life already young was hard because I'm like, these things, just normal day life is hard. It wasn't until I got into high school that I think things kind of got life got more intense. You know, I'm in a public high school. People are now dating and people are driving. So like dating actually matters now. It's not just saying you're dating someone. And so relationships got more real. So that's when I'd say I was really faced. I was like, I was attracted to the men, not every man, but a lot of the guys at school. The problem was I didn't trust them. Little caveat that I do think is important. When I was young, my dad sat me down and kind of had the quote unquote sex talk, birds and the bees. And his went something like, all men are dogs and they want to use you, period. And, you know, I didn't think that really had an effect on me, to be honest. I was probably fifth, sixth grade, maybe. I was the youngest of his children and I was the only girl. And so I think he just wanted to kind of scare me from guys so that I wouldn't get hurt. So his little girl wouldn't get, you know, used. The problem was we didn't have any more conversation. He didn't unpack that. And so really, I mean, going into high school, I kind of saw some of that. I'm like, oh, these guys are using my friends. It does seem that way. And that lie that all men are dogs just kind of got solidified from different people. And so, I mean, our hearts are the most sensitive thing. So I'm like, no way. I'm not going to let someone in. But the problem was I found them attractive, but I didn't find them safe. And so what do you do? You know, freshman, sophomore year, I could kind of skate by. But into my junior year, I'm like, I'm lonely. All my friends have boyfriends. All my guy friends have girlfriends. And I'm like, what am I supposed to do? And the few guys that I did date seemed to kind of fall in line with the type of guy my dad described. And so my experience was even like, no, I'm not doing this. But my heart was still hungry for companionship. My heart was still hungry for to do life with someone, right? It wasn't a sex-driven thing. It was companionship. And I found that in my best friend. I found that as a female my senior year in high school. And now keep in mind the framework of God as a cop. You know, for me, if you're driving along the freeway and the speed limit's 75, but the guy next to you is going 80, you know, 85, I can go 80. Like, he's going to get pulled over. And so I look around in high school and I'm like, one of my best friends is pregnant. The other ones are drinking. They're high. I'm like, what's the big deal if I kiss my best friend? I mean, if it's mutual and she wants to, what's the problem? It's less offensive. It's less sinful. So I thought, to what everybody around me is doing. So what's the problem? And it was a huge problem. I acted on it my senior year of high school. And honestly, that one decision, on top of many others, changed everything for me.
How is it that one experience, that one instant changed everything for you?
Yeah. So, you know, you can think that you like something or you want something, but once you've tried it, you know if you like it or you don't, or you have a better idea and you'll either try it more or you'll be like, I never want that again. Well, my experience was, this is what I wanted. I wanted companionship. I wanted safety. I want to not feel used. And that's what I felt like I had with my best friend. And now we just had a physical connection that was like, oh, I have someone now. She's not just my friend and she's friends with everybody. Like, we have something special. The problem with that was that it was distorted. And it didn't work out the way that I hoped or thought or envisioned. But I knew what I experienced, I liked. I mean, that's why Jesus says it. He says, taste and see that I'm good. Taste and see. We're built for experience. And if we don't experience Christ and the things he has for us, there's plenty of other things we can experience. And for me, I experienced other than what God had for me. And that's what felt, as much as I knew it was wrong, the act of, not just the desires, but the act of what I was doing was wrong, it still felt safe. It felt safer than being with a man. And that's not an excuse, but I was like, okay. And I would say probably the first worst decision I made was I didn't bring anybody into this. I just tried to figure it out by myself. I did this in isolation. I felt like if I were to share what I was going through, that I would just get the same talk that I feel like I received most of my life in private Catholic school was, it's sin, don't do it. Do the good, don't do the bad. And I'm like, well, clearly I can't. So I just didn't want to hear that. And so I, and not saying that that's what I would have received, but that's what that's what the enemy was telling me I would have received. And so I kept quiet.
Right. It kept you from the conversation.
Oh, big time. Yeah.
Instead of maybe you might have found somebody who could really speak to what your heart was desiring.
I was also afraid that if I talk to people within the church, that they're going to be like, oh, maybe you're supposed to be a nun. And I'm like, oh gosh, that to me was scarier than anything. I'm like, I'd rather be alone. You know, at that time in my life, I'm like, no, especially remember my image of God. To be married to someone who's just going to have me under a magnifying glass my whole life as a wife? No, thank you. As a bride? And so, yeah, it was scary. And fear. I see a thread of fear throughout my whole life. It was fear of the unknown, fear of being alone, fear. And we know that fear is the opposite of faith.
So listen, just as a little aside, and then we'll get back to the story, because it dawns on me that there is a fear, I think, of men, of sex today, perhaps experienced by a lot of young women, because pornography is so rampant. And so there's this idea of what sex is that is fed by porn. And it has changed men's desires on some level, where there may be an expectation that what a sexual relationship should be like is like what they're viewing. And it's interesting to me that so many young girls have not necessarily gone to the extreme of, like, you know, surgeries to do something to their bodies, but almost have run away from being women to some degree. And do you think that could be the result, at least in part, of almost saying, hey, if that's what it means to be a woman, then I'm out kind of idea?
Absolutely. This look, as women, we're meant to be protected. Right? Like we, God is our protector. And then he's given us men, whether it be as a husband or brothers or friends, but to be protected. And we feel like the one who's supposed to protect us is going to hurt us. And unfortunately, we can have one really bad experience and apply that to everyone. Right? Or we can hear of someone else's experience and apply that to all. And so I do, I think in many ways, not only then, but even more so now, like you said, with pornography, with all the different ways that us human beings are truly abusing each other. We turn inward and turn to other. It's the garden all over again, you know, in a way.
So back to the question about you having been living a double life, could you express what was going on there and what you were experiencing at that time?
Yeah, that whole double life started out very slow. It started with, I'm not going to tell anyone what happened between me and my best friend. And so I hid that. You know, we hide what we feel ashamed of, right? And so I hid that. I was like, nobody can know. There's no way I'm going to be called gay. There's no way I'm going to deal with this. I'm not gay. I just like her, you know? And so, yeah, that just kind of started things. And then I was like, wait a minute, you know, I started out of high school, I started selling real estate and everybody's dating, everybody's, you know, was older. So they were married and had kids and people were starting to ask questions. Why aren't you dating? So I was like, okay, I'm going to just start dating guys. And I wanted to be honest, I really did. I wanted to find a good man that wouldn't take advantage of me. And I found a few, but it just, we never lined up. And so I just felt safer with women. So I was dating guys on the forefront and doing things with women that I felt safe with and comfortable with. And though the women and I were never dating openly, it's where I felt my heart was being fed. It's where I felt like the longing for companionship and affection, and not even sexual, just affection, affection and also intimacy. And not just sexual intimacy. A lot of this did not start out sexual. There was physical intimacy, but it wasn't always sexualized. It turned into that over the course of years. But I didn't want anybody to know because I didn't want to deal with reality. And I thought the reality was going to be, you're going to be alone for the rest of your life, or you're going to be a religious sister, a nun.
So when did that change? Did it ever become a situation in which you just fully embraced that was who you were and decided to live that lifestyle fully out in the open? And what was that like for you, if that is what happened, with regards to maybe the tensions that you were experiencing? And how was that life for you as far as providing the satisfaction that you were hoping for to those desires and hopes and needs?
Yeah. So I actually was, even while I was doing all this, I was seeking. I hired a Catholic counselor on my own. Nobody knew. I was meeting with a priest. I asked a Protestant pastor, and everybody that I talked to was just affirming that God is love and that love is love. And I should be with whoever I want so long as it's monogamous. You know, a lot happened. I wrote a book. So there's a book out there that gives way more details. But just for time's sake, it wasn't until I got with the counselor and he's like, it's the cheating, it's the hiding that is causing you all this lack of peace. And I'm like, really? I don't think so. But I took it, I kind of took his advice per se. And so through some different events that happened, I got caught in one of the relationships I was in with a female. And I knew at that moment I could have lied and I could have got myself out of it and totally just never dealt with it. But I was done hiding. And I didn't know what not hiding would look like, but I was just done hiding. And so I ended up saying, yes, I've been seeing this girl and we're dating. And I don't know what to do. And it was a mess. I was married at that time to a man. And I'm not going to get into all the details. Like I said, if people want more, there's plenty of my testimony out there. But to answer your question, I did live open and out. I was like, okay, then I think for me to feel the peace and the freedom that I know I'm supposed to have, then I must just stop lying, cheating, and living this double life. I'll just live one. Even though I knew it was wrong, but I had priests telling me it was okay. I had my Catholic counselor telling me it was okay. I had a Protestant pastor telling me it was okay. And I didn't go handpick these people. I wasn't like, oh, who's quote unquote gay affirming? That wasn't even right. A thing then. And right. So these were people that were in my life and I trusted. One was my parish priest. And the Catholic counselor was suggested by another priest. And so, you know, I had leadership telling me it was okay. And I went full bore into the lifestyle. I openly dated the woman I was cheating on my husband with. And I was miserable. I was absolutely miserable. There were parts of my heart that felt fulfilled. I was like, okay, I have someone. But deep down, I knew we're not going to be together forever. This is not what God intended. And I remember even a year into our relationship, she was like, I can't wait to have a baby with you. I'm like, oh gosh, no, never. I said, I'm not bringing a child into this. I said, I don't even think it's right. I mean, I'd have these conversations with my girlfriend. We never lived together, but spent a lot of time. And I remember some nights just being like, this is wrong. And she's like, why are you with me? And I'm like, because I don't want to be alone. I mean, it sounds horrible, but I was so scared of what it would mean to be alone in a world that seems like everyone has someone. And I was just going to have the invisible God, you know? And so, yeah, it was miserable. I did not have peace. I was like, bye to the counselor. I'm like, you're not helpful at all. You're actually making me question my faith, which, you know, it brought more confusion. The priest, I put him to the fire too. And was like, wait, why are you saying this is okay? Nothing about this is okay. I don't have peace. Like, you know, and I'm not lying and I'm not cheating and I'm not going behind everybody's back. So, you know, yeah, it was really frustrating to still be now in this new place and still not have peace.
Hello, and thanks for being with us here on A Reason for Hope podcast. Been very grateful of the many years that we've been doing this for you. This is our sixth season with hundreds of podcasts already released. Although they're free to watch and listen to, they're not free to produce. So I'm asking that you discern to contributing and donate to A Reason for Hope podcast. We're a nonprofit organization. Every dollar, every penny is tax deductible. All you have to do is go to our website and click donation and navigate the podcast. All the funds that you donate will go to the production of this podcast. Thanks again, and may God bless you.
I'll come back to the question about affirming versus loving, because it seems like there was a confusion there with all the people that you were talking to, right? Because the loving thing would have been to, in a loving way, share the truth with you. And instead, they just affirmed you in what was a sinful situation, which would seem to be contrary to love. But you point to a time, I want to get to the conversion point. Like, when was this time, this moment, when things like changed for you? You experienced something, a specific moment crying out to God, you write about. Can you talk about that? Because that's obviously very pivotal in your story.
Absolutely. That day, October 17th, 2014, feels like it was my day of birth, like for real. A little over 11 years ago. You know, I had been dating women. The first one, we broke up, went to another, and always monogamous, and still the same cycles. And I'm like, you know what? It wasn't until that October 17th that I said, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. God, I've heard about you all my life. I've heard about you. I've heard you're good. I've heard this, but all I know are your rules, and I need you to show up, and I need you to show me that you're good at being God. And I said, and if you do, if you show up and if you let me experience your goodness, I said, I think you'll have me for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. I said, but I can't go off of just like knowledge in my mind. Right. I need to experience you. I've experienced a lot of the world and it's hurting me, and I'm hurting others. Like, I knew I wasn't created to hurt people, but I'm like, I keep getting hurt. I'm hurting people. This is a mess. God, you need to show up. And he did. And yeah, I mean, that experience with God absolutely changed everything for me. I didn't become perfect, but it changed everything. The cry of my heart, it was actually beautiful because a good friend of mine was in the car when I cried this prayer out. And he was just praying. He was not joining me. He did not say a word. He just let me do what I was doing with God. It was as if, it was almost like God's like, you're going to want a witness for this, you know? But he was just so loving and just so present, my friend. And he's the one that brought me to the church, this Protestant church, and went to this prayer meeting. And the encounter I had with Jesus, I will never forget. I will never forget that evening.
Describe a little bit about what sort of release you felt there, because I think that's important. You know, like, what you had talked a lot about how you felt unrest. So what did you feel when you knew that it was God being so present to you in that powerful way?
For the first time, I felt held. I felt safe. I felt like whatever that cry of my heart, that uninhibited, unscripted cry of my heart that I feel like was in there for so long, was released to God. He came in like a rushing wind, and I felt like he held me. I felt like he held me. He didn't condemn me. He didn't tell me all the bad things I did. I felt like as a father would run to a hurting daughter, he came and he just held me and spoke life over me, spoke victory over me. It was one of the most powerful encounters to my soul, my heart. It was for hours. I was on the ground for hours in the presence of God. And when I got up, I wasn't the same. I had a hunger for what I just experienced. See, remember, isn't this interesting? I tasted and experienced homosexuality and I wanted more. That night on October 17th, when I cried out to Jesus, I tasted and I experienced him and I wanted more. The hunger for God was stronger than any other hunger or desire I had. That taste, that experience with him left me hungry for more of him. I started going to daily mass. I started going to Protestant prayer meetings. Anywhere or anything that looked, smelt, or reflected Jesus, I showed up. I was ravenous. It was like my soul was so parched, and I finally tasted water. I experienced water and I was like, where are the wells? And I will be there. And that kind of hasn't stopped.
That's just beautiful. Thanks for sharing that. That's powerful. So where did your life go from there? I mean, you said how you threw yourself totally into your faith and you just sought God because you had tasted and seen how good he is. So how did you go from there to experience a call on your life to share your story?
Oh, well, it's been messy. I would love to say like, oh man, since October 17th, I've just been this perfect Christian. No, it's been messy. I have not been faithful. I have failed. I have fumbled. Sometimes I've chose, as even as the scripture says, like a dog that returns to its throw up. I'm not proud of those times, but my goodness, I never realized this, but I asked God to show me that he was good. And I realized he's never stopped showing me since I cried out. He's never stopped showing me he's good, even in the midst of my failures. That's actually when I've seen his goodness even greater, is when I know for a fact that I am not worthy of it. When I know for a fact that I failed, I messed up, I made a bad decision, and he shows up faithful and strong and forgiving. Now, what I will say, there was always a grace on my heart or in my heart for repentance. I was always sorry. I didn't always make the best decisions, but I was always sorry. There was and still to this day is a place, I think a gift that God's given me of contrition. And he responds to that. I mean, it says in the scriptures where sin abounds, grace abounds even more. Right. And I've lived that. I've experienced it. And it wasn't until a few years, probably 2 years in. And it was really, I believe, the hand of God, because I didn't want to share with anyone. I mean, telling everything I've done, being married, cheating on my husband, living this double life, lying to everybody I love and know. I mean, it's miserable. It's gross. But it was real. And I thought that just could stay between me and God. and then that'd be it. He just had a different way. And because I was beginning to trust him, he would invite me to do things. And I'm like, but I don't want to. And he's like, okay, you know, never forced me. But when I had one of my first experiences, I told the Lord I would do it once. I said, I will share once. It was at a women's prison. I said, I will share this one time and that's it. But the experience, and I write about it in the book, the experience that I had and the women's response to the mercy and goodness of God through sharing my testimony, I was like, God, you've got me. You've got me. If this is what you're going to do, I'm in. And it hasn't stopped since then. And there's many times I'm like, God, pick someone else, please. I don't have this together. I'm still a mess. I still struggle. Can you please pick someone who gets it? Like who can do this better? And I feel like he's like, there's not a lot of people I have to choose from, you know, he's kind of like, I'm maybe, you know, one of very few who maybe have this testimony and then to whatever degree are willing to share it for his glory.
You know, I've heard it said that Satan looks like your friend before you sin and Jesus looks like your enemy before you sin, right? Like Jesus saying, no, you can't, you know, he's whatever, you shouldn't do that, and that's the thing we want to do, so he seems like an enemy, but Satan's like, go ahead. And then afterward, it's Satan who's the accuser. Look what you did. He wants to like trap us in our shame. And yet Jesus is the friend who says, come to me, you know, I love you. Like, and so even your experience of like when you had fallen, the fact that it was there that you just experienced this love and closeness and presence of the Lord is powerful to me. You know, a little bit of a pivot with that is to talk about maybe the church's teaching on these topics and maybe how, you know, that there's a certain wisdom there. You know, you talk a lot about identity and your identity not being so much like founded in our sexuality or even our desires, but rather in being a beloved son or daughter of God. So, you know, how did that change in perspective change you and transform you? And then, you know, maybe share some of what you share when you're talking to people about these things.
Yeah. You know, there's a beauty of the teachings of the church. It doesn't mean that you're going to love them, but the beauty is that they're true. And if we would trust God, we'll experience the beauty. But it takes a surrender. I mean, to surrender something means you trust someone. or you're forced. And most of my life I felt forced, but I realized that was never God. Just as you said, that's the enemy trying to convince me that God's forcing me. When love is not forced, and we know that love is not love, God is love. And so he's not forceful. The teachings of the church in regards to sexuality, in regards to sin, it's beautiful and it's hard. But there's beauty. I mean, there's hope in this. And one of my favorite teachings, which is the one I avoided like the plague, is in the Catechism. It's number 2358. And it's just so beautiful. I bring it up so often because it really does. People ask me sometimes, you know, why does the church hate gay people? And I'm like, oh, that question, there's so much in that. I could spend an hour just unpacking that. One, I don't believe there's just gay people. I think we're broken people and we go to broken vessels. We go to brokenness. And then the church doesn't hate people. No, what the church that Christ set up, the church hates sin because who's behind sin is Satan. And Satan is the hateful one, but in it's beautiful when you really go through the teaching of this particular teaching line by line and you hear it, you won't hear hate. You might hear difficulty, but you don't hear hatred. And we really need to be careful of that. And it's actually very compassionate. It's very loving. It's beautiful. And I won't unpack it, but I will read it real quick if you don't mind.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Fantastic.
So it says, the number of men and women who have deep-seated homosexual tendencies is not negligible. It's not to be ignored, right? That's not hateful. The church has recognized there's a lot of people. It says, this inclination, which is objectively disordered, constitutes for most of them a trial. This is where I think sometimes we start to feel like we hear hate. You know, well, they're disordered. No. It says this inclination is disordered. And I just want to pause there because if any human being, Christian, non-Christian, whatever, believes that they don't have some sort of disordered desire, they're wrong. Every human being has some disordered, I would actually even say has multiple disordered desires, right? But that doesn't mean I'm a disorder. It means I have disordered desires, which there's a beauty because we have a God of order who wants to help bring our lives into right order, his order, which is going to bless us and going to bless the world around us. And so it would be different. It says these people are disordered. Well, that's a problem. No, this inclination. And then it says this, and I'll end on this one. It has a few more sentences, but this is a good one to wrap up. It says, they must be accepted with respect, compassion, and sensitivity. They, meaning the human being. Not every desire they have, not every inclination they have, but they as a human being need to be, they must be, it says, accepted with respect, compassion, and sensitivity. It says the person must be accepted, not everything the person is doing, not everything the person is choosing to do in their life, because that wouldn't actually be honoring or compassionate to the person if we just blessed everything every human does. That wouldn't fall. And so it's no different with sexuality, whether it be homosexuality or premarital sex or abortion or all the things, drug use, all the things that we go to in our broken humanity.
Now that's amazing. And by the way, I think what you did there was really clear up what many people, I think, misunderstand. They conflate things that shouldn't be conflated. And again, I think that probably the evil one wants them to, because he wants them to stay away. He wants them to see the church as hateful and what God's commandments as hateful. But God is for us. He's not against us, right? So his law is a law of love, a law of freedom, a law that wants us to experience the fullness of our being, not to diminish it, you know? And I think that's what you bring out so beautifully there.
Well, and if you think about it, if Satan's number one job is to convince us that God is not good, he's also going to try to convince us that his house is not good, that the home that God created for us here on earth is not good, because guess what? That's where we get fed. And so there's people out there like, yeah, God, he's fine. But oh, his church, no way. Because that's the place of feeding. That's the place of sacramental life where our souls get fed in a heavenly divine way that we cannot fully describe here on earth, but that Jesus set up. And so sometimes I feel like Satan is even okay. Like, yeah, whatever. I can't convince them God's not good, but I will make sure they don't get fed through his home. And so I think that's why some people are like, yeah, I'm okay with God. But nah, his church, because that's the place of feeding. That's the place of encounter. Not that God doesn't encounter outside. I mean, I was at a prayer meeting in a industrial building, and God was present. But where I continue to get fed is in his church.
You know, and I think that's a really interesting point, because that is where all the attention goes. The church is against us. The church is against us. The church needs to be more welcoming, whatever that means. Like, you know, there's always that criticism. And on some level, maybe even some leaders in the church buy into that, you know, and start to say, yeah, we should be more welcoming. But there's still this problem of conflating different things. Like a person... I think it's very common in our culture today for someone to see what they desire or what they think or their experience in their consciousness as being who they are, or they experience somehow they conflate this idea that like what I do is who I am. So if you're saying like, you know, what I'm doing is wrong, then you're against me and you're saying I am wrong. If you're saying what I desire is wrong, then you're against me and I am wrong. But that's not saying the same thing. And I think that, you know, you did so beautifully, you know, clarified what I think is for people a misunderstanding. But I think it's a misunderstanding because people view their own identity wrong, right?
This is an identity crisis.
This is an identity problem, right? Exactly.
Yeah. And I think that that also stems from the fact that we're trying to make us who we are. What I do is who I am. And that creeps into the church. Oh, if I don't know what my vocation is, your vocation is to be loved by God and to love him in return. That's our vocation. Our vocation and our destination is to be with God forever. And sometimes we get so hung up on the things we do that we forget what Jesus did makes us who we are. Not what I do. I can receive him or I can reject him, but it's what Christ did on the cross. It's what he did. It's what God did for me and for you that makes me a son and a daughter, right? That makes us sons and daughters. And so we can get beside ourselves in that. I mean, I was doing missions work I've had a mission in Ethiopia for 19 years now. People used to call me a missionary. I'm like, I'm not a missionary. They're like, but you moved, you sold everything. You have over 500 kids, you help orphans and widows. And I was like, yeah, I do. And they're like, well, then you're a missionary. I'm like, no, that's what I do. It's not who I am. And then, oh, you're a realtor, you're an author, you're a writer, you know, you're a speaker. No, that's just what I do. Right. And so even when I was dating women, they're like, oh, we're so glad you finally came out as gay. I'm like, I'm not gay. It's just what I'm doing. It's who I'm attracted to. It's the lifestyle I'm living, but it's not who I am. See, you can know who you're not and still not know who you are. And if we don't know the identity as a beloved son or a beloved daughter, then the world will throw and try to get anything else but that, because that holds power. Me being a beloved daughter, not just a daughter, but a beloved one, changes everything.
That's beautiful. Listen, one thing that young people and really all people crave is a sense of belonging. Nowadays, those who come out as gay or lesbian or bisexual or trans immediately get publicly affirmed and become embraced by a community. So it seems to meet that need. But we had talked about before, affirmation is not the same thing as love. You know, so can you comment on this? Because I think this is one of the things, especially in social media worlds, where people who are almost encouraged to identify themselves with their desires or their feelings or their struggles, because that's going to give me a community in which I belong and of people who love me.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, absolutely. And I think it's important to look at, you're a part of that community until you're not. Hmm. So, but this is something I think we can learn as a church. I think the LGBT community in particular is doing something right that we're missing as a church, because they're really welcoming. And sometimes we're not. Sometimes you've got to look a certain way, act a certain way, and get in line before you can really experience God. And that's just not the gospel. That's not true. He said he came for the sick. He came for the hurting, the broken, the imprisoned, the blind, right? And so I think sometimes people are drawn to other because the church, we're not being who we're called to be. We sometimes act more like the older brother in the story of the prodigal son that crosses our arms and can't celebrate when someone comes home because they don't look as they should. They're not cleaned up enough yet. And it's like, wait, isn't this a hospital? Isn't this where we get well? I got to get clean before I come to the hospital. I got to get healthy before I, no. And so they're going, people are, the family of God is going into a false family, because I think a lot of times we as church don't know how to be welcoming. And then we start affirming things that God doesn't affirm, or we start shaming things that God's not shaming. He doesn't shame, you know? And so it's like, it's this chasm between that. I really believe there's the mercy of God trying to wake up us as the body of Christ to say, wait a minute, why are children of God running to not the family of God? And we can point at Satan all day long, or we can take a real examination and say, God, where am I missing this? Where am I being maybe that older brother? Or where am I maybe being this like hippie that's just like, yeah, whatever, like everything's good, it doesn't matter. And celebrating sin. And so I think that that's sometimes why these other groups are growing so rapidly. That should be what the church looks like, where it's like, come right as you are, come as you are. And let Jesus embrace you and let him do the work he wants to do.
Well, that's really powerful. And so like you're bringing attention to something I think that's important, is that there's two extremes to be avoided, right? There's the extreme where you have to measure up before you can be welcomed. But then there's almost like a false welcoming where everything is being affirmed that you're doing as if it's not a problem, or as if it's really going to bring about your fulfillment when it's not. It almost sounds like, you know, Jesus saying, you know, I do not condemn you, now go and sin no more, right? I mean, that sounds like the balance right there. And then what accompaniment I think means in that regard is that you're walking with people as they are trying to have the Lord change them, and you're walking with them patiently. You know, that's not going to be necessarily for many even an overnight change, you know, but it's going to involve falling and getting back up and going to confession and asking God for grace and everything else. But it's always walking towards a goal, right? It's not just, I'm walking with you just the way you are so that you can stay just the way you are. God's calling you to something higher and more beautiful, right?
I'm the friend that wants to walk with you, and I'm the friend that needs him too. We can't forget that the person we're walking with doesn't need Jesus more than you do, doesn't need Jesus more than I do. If we were able to see the reality of our own soul, we would be walking with each other in desperate need together. I still need Jesus just as much as I did 11, 12, 13, 17 years ago. If not, I actually might be aware that I actually think I need him more now than I even did then.
Well, and we're very good at, like, you know, convincing ourselves really not as bad as, you know, it's a defense mechanism to say, I'm not as bad as that guy, you know?
I mean, right? That's a Pharisee, right? In the right? Back saying, God, I fast, I do this. Thank God I'm not like him. And it said one left justified.
Right. Or even like, you know, yeah, okay. So I'm not out there doing these terrible things that are terrible from the outside, but I've got judgment in my heart and I gossip and I, you know, like there's all those things, you know, like, and somehow those don't seem as big a deal, but read the Gospels. Jesus is pretty strong on it. St. Paul's pretty strong on it, you know,
like he's got a whole list, and it's not just homosexuality.
That's right. That's right.
And he says they won't inherit the kingdom of heaven.
Right. And so it's not small. And yet we tend to think it's light, right? So those are really powerful points. For parents hearing this, you talk about the church. For parents hearing this, or for other family members who obviously love their children dearly and yet are seeing them struggle, not only personally, but maybe because of the messages they're getting in school, because of what they're experiencing on social media. I mean, let's face it, there is sort of like a whole-scale indoctrination that's taking place as well. So what do you say to them about practical steps they can take? And without being so, like you might say, simplistic as a do this, don't do this, what kind of advice can you offer them as they try to walk with their children, in this struggle?
Number one, pray, which most people are like, yeah, I already do that. Well, we have to remember the battle is not with flesh and blood. It's not you versus your children. It is spirit and principality. It is Satan versus us, God's loved ones. And he wants to do everything he can to take us down. So prayer, fasting is big too. Prayer and fasting. Jesus said it. Some things only go by prayer and fasting. So don't lose sight of those. And then I would say, be curious. Be curious about your child's life. Honey, how long have you been feeling this? Is this something you remember for a long time? Just be curious. Don't have the answer. Don't have the solution. There is one answer. There is one solution, and it's Jesus. And they most likely know that. But if they're not living that, then be curious. Hey, how do you see God? Oh, see God? I don't see God. He doesn't see me. Whatever. Be curious. See what comes out. Pray before you say, Holy Spirit, guide me. Jesus said, it's better that I go so that you have my spirit within you. He's the counselor. He's the guide. He's the confidant. He will guide us. That's when the church came alive, is when the Spirit of God fell and came and took up dwelling within us. Trust that God is bigger than Satan. Do not be afraid of Satan. God, we cannot walk around scared. I get it. It's terrifying to see our loved ones bound by sin. Jesus set prisoners free. He did, he does, and he always will. Trust in that. You are not meant to be Jesus, but be curious about their life. Be the expression of Christ to your loved ones. There's that saying, sometimes you're the only gospel someone will ever read. Does your life reflect the radical love of Jesus Christ, the radical truth and love of Jesus Christ? Not just the law of Jesus Christ. No, the love that God said in his word, it says that God proved. God didn't have to prove anything to us, but his humility to say, I want to prove to them that I love them, and I'm going to send my son while they were still sinners and die for them. Does your life reflect that radical love that while your child is still a sinner, you would lay your life down for them and you will not let go of them? But you're not clenching on. You're just saying, I'm with you. I'm with you, honey. That doesn't mean I love everything you're doing, but I don't love everything dad does either, right? Like, tie others into it. Don't just make them feel like the leper because they struggle with homosexuality. I have so many parents, and I'll wrap it up on this. I have so many parents that reach out to me and they're like, Kim, I don't know what to do. My daughter just told me she's gay, or I found out my son is, dating a guy. I don't know what to do. And it's interesting. Almost every time I'm like, do you have any other children? Well, yeah, but they don't have that struggle. I said, okay, but they have a struggle. Are you just as worried about theirs? No, not really. Okay, well, get just as worried. No, not worried, but get just as aware. And give it the same attention and affection. See, because I think sometimes what we're doing is we're creating modern day lepers out of people who have these attractions to the same sex. For whatever reasons they have it, we're ostracizing and saying it's the worst. No, it's not. No, it is not. It is one of the sexual sins. It is one of the disordered desires, but it is not the only one. And so really bringing all your children to the Lord. And then guess what? Your daughter who struggles with homosexuality is like, wait, you pray for my brother, Mark, just as much as you pray for me? Oh yeah, honey, he's got struggles too. And guess what? I pray for dad just as much, and I pray for myself just as much, because we all need Jesus. Man, that's a lot more appealing. And let's be honest, it's true. Whether right. you want to admit it or not, but it is true.
It's true. That is a beautiful word. Thank you for that. That's awesome. I know that's going to encourage a lot of people. And listen, this has been really a wonderful conversation. I think it's so important to have. I think that so many people are struggling as you struggle and yet feel alone in their struggle. I think many people have had the experience that you've had where there is a policeman God or an accountant God, and that's how they view things. And there seems like there could be no redemption for them, that they're just not capable, that they're not good enough. Of course they're not. None of us are. And yet you said something important, I think, for people who walk with them. And that is to, I think, first and foremost, remember that you need Jesus just as much. And we all, because we have original sin. It's funny, you were saying before, like, you know, that the desire is disordered. But the fact of the matter is, because of original sin, we have a constitutional disorder. Every single one of us is inclined to all the wrong things, you know, because of the effects of original sin on us, you know. And so we forget that is the supreme disorder that manifests itself in many different ways, right? And we've all got it. And it doesn't take long to look at one's life and to look in one's heart to know you got it. So we have to keep that first and foremost in our minds when we're walking with people, and thank Jesus for his love and mercy ourselves. So this has been terrific. Is there anything that you'd like to share? You know, I don't know if there's, you mentioned your book, maybe you could tell people the title of the book and where they can get it. If there's anything online that you'd like to draw their attention to, because I'm sure that a lot of people would love to learn more about you and the work that you're doing to help people discover who they really are in Jesus.
Yeah. So most resources are on my website. It's called Boldly Beloved. We're bold because we're beloved, not because I'm just born bold. So boldlybeloved.com, it has resources for parents, resources for those who struggle, not every resource, but the ones that have been helpful to me and to others that I walk with. A lot of testimonies on there, a lot of different videos and things that answer a lot of questions. And then it has the new show that I partnered with EWTN or with as well called Here I Am Stories. And it's just testimony after testimony after testimony, long form testimonies of these people's stories who lived in radical darkness and all within the LGBT community. That is not me shaming a people group. There's an agenda from Satan and Satan is capturing people. But many of these people, all of them on this show have come out of that lifestyle and into Christ. And so I think you'd be really encouraged. The scripture says that testimony is prophecy into someone else's life. So I encourage you to watch those testimonies, to trust that the Lord is writing stories in your own loved one's life, and to remember that no one is too far gone from the radical love and mercy of God. There is hope for every soul. And yes, we have to be open, but God can do things far above and beyond what we could think or imagine. And so none of your loved ones are too far gone.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for this time together, Kim. God bless you and all that you're doing for the Lord. And we'll be in touch. Hopefully we'll reconnect again in the future.
Amen. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Bye-bye now.
In addition to producing this podcast, Array of Hope is also known for producing events such as retreats, missions, conferences, and concerts. If you'd like to learn more about what we offer, just go to our website and click on Experience. There you can see and learn all the various programs that we offer. God bless you, and we hope to see you soon.